Machine zao se anerudo, atakuwa corona. Machine zao se, atakuwa corona, corona we.
Corona
we.
Capital 263.
Welcome to Politics and Beyond on Capital 263. My name is Christopher Farai Charamba.
My name is Upenyu Makoni Matenga.
And I'm Tawanda Henry Beatty. And thanks for joining us for this retrospective or this eulogy episode. I think today we are mostly speaking about the late Dr. Richard Morgan Tsvangirai. And no jokes at the beginning, but I'm sure we'll pepper some jokes throughout the podcast.
Yeah,
I think it
wouldn't be Politics and Beyond if there weren't a couple of jokes.
some chuckles.
But it is a bit of a somber mood, and it's also not our usual recording day. Today we're recording Monday, 19th February. It's even Maneru for some of us, which is again weird, but
and it's Tuesday morning for Tawanda.
Yeah, it's six a.m. on Tuesday, the 20th of February.
So, yeah, it's just one of those situations. But yeah, as Tawanda said, today is the life and times of Dr. Morgan Richard Tsvangirai, who passed away last week on Valentine's Day in South Africa. Just going to go through a quick bio just so that we get a bit of information on who the man was. Most of us, I'd like to believe that most of the people listening to the podcast as well are well aware of who he was and what he did, but you know, it's always good to look back at someone's life. So he was born in Buhera when it was still, you know, Southern Rhodesia, on the 10th of March 1952, to Karanga Shona parentage. He was the eldest of nine children. He did his primary education at St. Mark's Koneso Primary School in Wedza, then was transferred by his father to Chikara Primary School in Gutu, then to Silvera. He did his secondary education at Gokomere High School. After that, in 1972, he got his first job as a trainee weaver for Elastics and Tapes Textile Factory in Mutare. In 1974, a friend of his encouraged him to apply for an apprentice at Anglo America's Bindura Nickel Mine, and he spent 10 years there, rising from plant operator to plant supervisor. In 1978, he married his first wife, Susan, and they had six children together during their 31-year marriage. He then married Lokadia Karimatsenga in 2011, and he married Elizabeth Macheka after he left Lokadia in 2012. He's been involved in politics and political activism for quite a long time, and through the trade unions, he was elected to the executive of the National Mine Workers Union. In 1989, he became the Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions. He chaired the National Constitutional Assembly. Sorry, I'm reading wrong here. He was part of the National Constitutional Assembly in 1997, and then
he chaired the task force of the National Constitutional Assembly.
That's exactly what it
While Tawanda Mtasa served as moderator, or you know, chaired the National Constitutional Assembly.
Thank you very much. And then in 1999, he founded and organized the Movement for Democratic Change. And their first task at the time was to campaign against the constitutional referendum, which they won, the no vote won. And then from then on, he went and contested in the 2002 presidential elections. So that's just a, you know, just a short bio of who he was. And I think during the course of this conversation, we'll be speaking a lot of the things that he did, especially his time in the MDC and all the his politics and some of the things that he went through, all from the time the MDC was formed in 99 all the way till his passing last week on the 14th of February 2018 at the age of 65. Yes, 65. He would have been
65.
Yeah, he would have been 66 this year.
Yeah, I think perhaps if Upenyu, you'd just like to say a few words quickly, and then we can move from them as a man, having paid respect to him as a man, and move to the politics and the political actions after having shown due consideration and due respect to him as a man, if that makes any sense. So mm-hmm. I don't know if you, from your perspective, if you had anything to say quickly.
Well, I think that regardless of your, you know, feelings about Morgan Tsvangirai as a human being, and of which, you know, I'm on record as having many feelings. I think you have to salute the fact that he is one of the prime movers in Zimbabwe for, you know, towards the democratic fight against the Robert Mugabe regime, cabal, junta, whatever you want to call it. And also that he was, I think the most notable thing is that he was a trade unionist, and his work for the trade unions. I remember the food riots of 1998, which he, I think he was involved in organizing those, or the food demonstrations. And I remember the, you know, the formation of the Movement for Democratic Change in 1999. And so, you know, you have to respect who he is in our history and the legacy that he has left behind, which is, you know, a firm foundation for opposition in Zimbabwe. Before MDC showed up on the scene, there was no opposition to speak of. And he created that space. He fought for that space. He paid for doing those things. He was arrested. He was beaten up quite famously. He was intimidated. And, you know, so, hey, man, I salute him.
Yeah. For my part, I don't know. The loss is quite heavy. To think of history, I remember him from, I think, around 2000 is when my clearest memories were, and I would have been 10. I remember him coming to the house, and it's a loud, boisterous man who my dad deferred to so much, and I wasn't used to seeing my dad defer to people in any capacity, because my granddad had been late, so I'd never really seen him with the father figure, someone who you'd see have that similar type relationship. So those are some of my earliest memories with him, and just the early days of the MDC with a camcorder, moving around mostly Harare East when you'd come to visit. And then seeing him go from this rough and tumble everyday man to a more refined politician, leader, someone who was acutely aware of his what people perceived as his weakness and self-educated, and I don't know, man. It's very sad for me. I think we lost a good one, and I don't think that we even right now as a country realize how fortunate we are to have. I think a lot of the freedoms we now take for granted, a lot of the bond note marches, a lot of the pasta ease, a lot of, even to an extent, our podcast, are things that perhaps we don't realize, particularly as a generation, for me personally, yeah, and our generation, we don't realize we're often unthinkable in 1999. It wasn't a fully totalitarian state, but when the opposition came, things for us, for a lot, got very bleak and very shut down. You know, there were days where the WISP MDC had to whisper or have meetings at night because it was too dangerous to have meetings in public. Not necessarily in the cities, but certainly in most parts of the country, outside of the cities. So I think history will smile upon his legacy. Yeah, that's it. That's it for me.
Yeah, I mean, some of the memories I have is obviously ndi Homboy. I'm also from Buera, and in fact, Ndisekuru, through marriage and all sorts of things. Saka, you know, it's always interesting because we've all kumshakwedu ku Buera. You have, you know, you had Kumbirai Kangai, you have Chinotimba, you have Charamba, you have Gono. So it was always hostile territory, somewhat for the MDC. But then you also have all these, you know, familial relations, and you know, you can't separate some of those things. So there are events where, you know, they are politicians, and I remember bumping, the first time I actually met him, I must have been, I don't know, 12, 13, I think, yeah, must have been around that age, and it was Pabuera Chaipo Pama Shops, and it was an interesting affair, because this was soon after the 2002 elections, and this was when the MDC, around that time when the MDC was not, I mean, Zimbabwe wasn't, let me say, as free as it is now in terms of opposition politics, and you know, that's saying quite a lot. And it was just, you know, you'd heard all these things and seen all these things, and you meet a man, a normal human being, and you know, he laughed, he was interacting with the people there, and obviously Kumusha, so everyone treats you, you know, like, you know, one of their own, and there's no pretense. But he was a very affable character, and it was interesting to see that, because in the build up or all the things you'd been seeing in the media, and obviously I was quite young, I didn't have a grasp on a lot of the political nuances, but it was just interesting and cool to see. And over the years, I think in the various speeches, just, you know, every time he's appeared in different spaces, you would have seen part of this character. And I think that's something that we always neglect when looking at individuals, regardless of the space, be it politics, arts, sports, is you sort of view them through one lens, and you forget everything else about them in terms of them being a human being and some of the things that people, you know, do and how they live their lives outside of the political realm, I think is also important. And I think one of the things that made him successful as a politician was his character and was his ability to interact with people and not seem as if he was, you know, above them, but he could actually be amongst the people. And I think that's something that comes from his background in the trade unions and being a trade unionist, because that's one of the spaces where you have to be amongst the people, because you're representing their interests, and at the same time you're also a worker, so you don't have one of those high positions that separates you from the people.
Yeah. Thanks. It's good. But I guess now, having acknowledged that we don't hear or you don't see in politics or from speeches or from interviews a full three-dimensional character, let's look at the one dimension that we are here for, essentially the political dimension and who he was as a political animal. I think it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's let's do our thing. I think it would be dishonest to Semuno, who went on Valentine's Day, Nerudo. I think part of loving someone is being able to talk about all the good and the bad and everything in between.
Right.
Shall we start with the trade unions?
Yeah, I don't know much about that, to be fair. I know, like you were saying, I know about those riots, those demonstrations in I think 98, 90. I think Black Thursday was in 1997, and I think that's when the currency started free falling, and food prices started increasing. And I know that there were major demonstrations in 98, 99. So I know that as a historical fact, but I don't know about
the organizing,
how it all came about, and what him and Gibson Sibanda had to do with it.
Well, I mean, I can tell you my experience of it. I don't have the exact historical timeline. What I do remember is that Zimbabwe signed on for ESAP, and then there was the program after ESAP, the Structural Adjustment Program, which was in theory supposed to, you know, fix the economy. Here we are 100 years later. But because as a consequence of poor management and poor decision-making on the part of the Zimbabwe government, TSU, ZANU-PF, food prices skyrocketed, and we have the notorious yellow maize being imported into Zimbabwe, which,
Kenya.
You know, I
Kenya.
Can tell you for fact,
Kenya.
Yes.
I remember
yes.
Kenya.
Yeah, I can tell you for a fact, it didn't taste like, you know, if you're a Sadza person, you're just going to have feelings about yellow maize. And, you know, as a consequence of skyrocketing food prices, the ZCTU in particular managed to organize workers into a demonstration or a protest against the government and skyrocketing food prices. But the backstory to this is that the ZCTU, the reasons why it was quiet until 1997, or until the mid to late 1990s, was because it was, whatever trade union existed then was, how can I put it? It was a stoolie of the ruling party. So it just did what the ruling party wanted. They just rubber stamped decisions. They did the Pamberi thing. They did the Pasi thing. They attended rallies like everybody else. And then when Mr. Tsvangirai came along, he was the Secretary General in 1989, and he led the ZCTU away from ZANU-PF, and he, you know, I think what he did was to infuse a consciousness into the workers' union that they didn't have to you know, they didn't have to follow what ZANU-PF did and wanted and so forth, and that workers' rights were real things, which is important, and I think which should always be reiterated, that workers' rights, I think it's sort of along the lines of where Linda Masarira's work was before as well, that, you know, time and time again, you forget the worker and the country, but that's who's the worst affected by a bad economy. So, yeah, that's him with the Congress of Trade Unions.
Yeah. And that's where I think, I guess, from his history in ZCTU and maybe before, that's where one of the my favorite ZANU talking points is, and you hear it oft repeated at elections, at rallies, kuti muge nangari wedu, muge ndiwe ZANU, takamuza udadzoke kumba. So I'm sure before, as any person of his age, I'm sure, you know, during independence, and before independence, I'm sure he was a card carrying member. In fact, I know for a fact he was a card carrying member of ZANU.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was up until 1988, I think.
He was the youth chairperson of ZANU Jongwe.
Oh, there you go then.
Yeah. So he wasn't just an ordinary card-carrying member. He was a leader of an iteration of
was
ZANU.
Shows he was always a leader. And he always had leadership potential. Even in ZANU, he could lead.
Don't get me started. Don't poke the bear. Why are you doing that?
Yeah.
Yeah, we could end up making a lot of ZANU jokes. Now's not the time for them.
For that. But yeah, ZCTU, I think the culmination of all of this was a date that has often been quoted, and obviously, I know the date off by heart for obvious reasons. It's the 26th of February, 1999, the Workers' People's Convention, was it the Working People's Convention?
The Working People's Convention.
The thing is, I was talking to Dad because I, in my head, thought I had actually been, I'd gone to that, but I hadn't gone to that. What I did go to was the launch of the MDC, which was later that year in September. I think September the 14th or the 11th is when the MDC was launched. I think I'm tempted to say it was the 14th.
I think it was the 11th.
The 11th. All right. If it had been the 14th, it would have been funny because the Working People's Convention would have been on my birthday and the launch of the party would have been on my sister's birthday. That's like the dates.
You're making it family affair again.
Yeah, it
was September 11th, 1999.
But yeah, so the Working People's Convention, I think it was unique in that it really was a cross-sectoral congregation of interests in Zimbabwe, interests that had not come together like that, perhaps maybe since independence. You know, there were churches, there were student leaders, there were trade unions, civic groups, Munwese, anyone who had an active interest in how the country was moving was there. And they came up with a number of resolutions, and most glaringly, war vets were there as well, just for people who forgot.
As people who work,
as war veterans.
Yeah, they work for the state.
No, yeah, I'm just saying they were represented as well, as in there's been a historical scrubbing of war veterans and their long association with the MDC and with Tsvangirai, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
Amongst the resolutions that came from the People's Working Convention is, of course, resolution number 11, which is that they should form a political party. And that political party became the Movement for Democratic Change, which was, it has its inaugural president, Morgan Richard Tsvangirai, and as vice president, Gibson Sibanda, who both were drawn from the the trade unions.
Mm-hmm.
While forming a political party nowadays in Zimbabwe is somewhat willy-nilly. Munhu wese ne briefcase rake ane computer ne access to Photoshop can form a party. At that time, it was significantly much more difficult, not just politically, but in terms of to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, waka former party that we now know as MDC, MDCT.
Yeah.
And
you're leaving out the NCA. I mean, between the Working People's Convention, you know, there was the campaign for no. Which, you know, Mr. Tsvangirai was quite a pivotal part of, against the 2000 or 2002 proposed constitution.
2000.
And he was an important part of the National Constitutional Assembly and an important part of campaigning against what, you know, was a travesty of a constitution at the time.
But by then,
but you compare campaign as MDC.
MDC had been formed.
Has been formed. I wasn't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
MDC had been formed, and in fact, at that time, I'm almost certain. Just from a personal perspective, I'm going from just memory. I don't have anything in front of me, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, the NCA offices were across from David Livingston, where that new Net One offices, and I think that's where people like Anabiti and were based. They weren't actually in MDC fully at that time. I think there's a little. I'm trying to find the message going around about the original structure of MDC. I think the only surviving member of that original structure is Chamisa. In terms of he was youth chairperson. But yeah, the NCA and the MDC were essentially symbiotic at that time, and they campaigned for no in that 2000 constitutional referendum.
Yeah, carry on.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I think one of the things in terms of the MDC and the formation of the MDC was that a lot of the support, you know, came from the workers, as the leaders of the MDC were part of the trade unions. But also it was the first time you had an opposition that was not a faction of ZANU-PF or opposition leaders who had not come from the hierarchy of ZANU or ZANU-PF. So before, I think in 1990 election, you had Tekere, you know, going against Mugabe in the presidential election. He lost, you know, dismally. And then 1995, you had Ntabaningi Sithole. All of these people at one point were from that, you know, liberation war era. They were all part of ZANU, part of the leadership of ZANU at some point, and then they had a falling out with Mugabe or with ZANU-PF, formed new parties, and then contested. Come MDC, come Tsvangirai, for the first time you had an opposition that was removed from that era, and it was taking Zimbabwe into a different space. And because it was a workers' party, you had younger people, and obviously drawing this and going to draw parallels to what's happening now with the MDC. But at the time, you know, it was comprised of people who were not of that generation, or not, definitely not of that generation that ZANU-PF was, that had gone to war. And I think this is where it found a lot of success, because it was a lot closer and a lot more in touch with the people, I think, than, and this is 1999, you know, I think it was a lot more in touch with the people than ZANU-PF was at the time. And that's why the no vote was so successful, because they had structures that existed and they were able to mobilize. And, you know, Tsvangirai, obviously, as someone who'd been working in the trade unions for a very long time, was able to tap into those individuals and into those structures and into those systems. And it helped in, you know, the formation of the party and getting the party to where it was. So from 2000, after the no vote, you then go to the 2002 presidential election, the first time he ran against former President R.G. Mugabe. And I'm trying to see if I can just pull up the results.
The results for the presidential election were 1,685,600,000. Wait for it. I'll just wait for it.
That's
Mugabe got 56% of the vote and Tsvangirai got 42% of the vote. Notable
1.6 to 1.2.
Yeah, a notable contestant in the election was Shakespeare Meyer, who got 11,000 votes in the school.
I remember that election.
The school of Ngosanamo.
Wow. Wilson Kumbula.
This one is an outlier.
Wilson Kumbula got 31,000 votes, actually. I think Ngosana will be in that region.
Kuma 11,000?
No, 31,000. Kwa Wilson Kumbula. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, okay. That's
this is before the parliamentary elections were harmonized.
I've just seen something here that will come up in another podcast. Please remind me at some point. But the registered voters for this election was 5.6 million, and I think we're sitting on the same level of registered voters. That's something interesting to look at another time. Carry on.
That is a very good point. Something to note.
Yeah.
And then from
elections. So, yeah, you're saying elections weren't harmonized at that time. So yeah, you had separate elections for Parliament and
the parliamentary elections that happened in 2000.
Yes.
And the MDC had won 47% of those,
mm-hmm.
of that. And I think that the House still only had about 160, or I don't know, I'm forgetting how many people they had at the time. But yeah, how many people did the parliament have before it?
Oh gosh, I'm not sure, and it's not something we're going to look up now. But I think let's just focus in terms of the leadership.
So 120 seats. So so MDC won 57 of the seats, and ZANU-PF won 63 of the seats. And then there were 15 challenges. in terms of in the courts, and I think about five of them were successful. So at the end, this article doesn't show that, but at the end, it actually ended up with ZANU-PF having more, MDC having more seats than ZANU-PF in 2000. Or it was almost a hung parliament from the 2000 elections.
Was Tsvangirai in parliament at that time? Did he ever go into parliament?
No, I don't think he was. I think he lost.
Okay.
He lost at the time.
Okay.
He lost in Bugera.
I told you, ku stronghold, ugogo.
Because gogo wakati awavote.
But as you know, if we go through this all through the years by years, we'll spend, you know, a decade
I just wanted to highlight around that period. I was going to move on from that period because something else happened after the 2002 presidential elections. Tsvangirai was then charged in 2003 with treason. The state versus Morgan Tsvangirai, a treason trial based off a recording of him paying Ari Ben Manashe a sum of money, and him talking about what it's going to be like to rule in the post-Mugabe Zimbabwe. The Cliff's Note version, basically, Ben Manashe was recording Tsvangirai while they were having a conversation. The state alleged that the conversation was to plot the assassination of Mugabe. The MDC and the opposition case was that they were simply paying Menashe's company to lobby the United States government. Whatever it was a bad look, and it was obviously a breach of trust. But eventually, he was acquitted in 2004, in October 2004, and that was that. But it was a trying time. I think, you know, social media, can you imagine being there? This must have been movies.
I mean,
like right now with live tweeting and everything, they would never allow for an open trial to go on like this against an opposition leader for something like this, unless they were absolutely certain that they could do it.
I think, you know, at the time, you know, in hindsight, things always, you know, seem different, because I suppose you remember different things, and obviously you were, again, different at the time, younger, and a whole lot, you know, a whole lot has gone on since then. But we also have to think that, again, like I mentioned, this was the first time that you had a formidable opposition, and it's no secret that I've not been an MDC supporter, but I would actually, you know, class, and I told you this, he's a hero and an icon, and that is because his contribution to democracy was him giving up his life, pretty much. No one knew what to expect. Even ZANU-PF at the time, in dealing with it, was figuring out ways to deal with this opposition. And it was also going through its own internal and external issues with the land reform and so many different things. And here you have this opposition coming up to challenge for, you know, to govern the state. And some of the things that happened during that period, I mean, we've seen the images, the arrests, the treason trial, and treason is not a small thing, because I believe, you know, death penalty.
The penalty is death.
The penalty is death, and with the way the state was set up, like you mentioned, there was no social media back then. Everything you got through the papers. And there was a heightened sense of fear because, you know, people wouldn't just talk about things because you don't know who's listening. And that fear still exists. Now everyone is a CIO operative. Anyone who follows you on Twitter could be a CIO operative. But I think it's different.
Like a Matigari.
At that time, it was genuinely quite scary. And his contribution, just in terms of the dedication for advocating for change, political change in the country, should never be underestimated and should never go unnoticed. And obviously, at the time, he was dealing with a younger Robert Mugabe, who, you know, was seething off a number of issues at the time. What was going on with international relations and the impending sanctions or sanctions that had come. I think they came in 2003 around that time, leaving the Commonwealth, losing the no vote in 2000. This was a regime out to destroy Tsvangirai, and those are some of the details that that shouldn't be understated, especially in the early days of the MDC and the work that the MDC tried to do.
They were, I don't know, it was a very, very different regime from what it is.
From the new dispensation. The
use of violence with impunity was very different. I think in our generation we've only seen tear gas and water cannons. And I mean, we've seen some pictures of people being beaten on the ground, but that was standard practice. Kumacha, you knew was going on Uroa. Like, it wasn't a joke. It wasn't
that, you know, the forceful boots on the street. It was also, I don't know how many of the people who are listening remember the 80s. People disappeared. Itai Dzamara, we'd speak about Itai Dzamara, but tens of people, hundreds of people disappeared in the 80s, just like Itai did, and we don't speak about them. Because, you know, like, maybe the difference is social media now. There were mysterious accidents involving army vehicles, trains, where people, whole families, you know, died. There were mysterious happenings where Zinzarachurese, you know, just was wiped off the face of the planet.
Explain to people, if people don't know, there's go on YouTube and look up ZANU-PF campaign adverts, car accidents, and there's literally an official ZANU-PF ad that used to air on ZBC where a car is driving and there's a screech and then car accidents. It's like, don't make a mistake, do the right thing, vote for ZANU-PF. And given that a number of commanders and cadres and people had passed away in car accidents, it was just the most on the nose and thing to do. But no, that's the level of that's the level of control that they had on and fear that they had on the country.
And now. Capital 263.